Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right State Auditor John Dougal.
Hey, Natalie Gochner. Great to be with you.
We are cheery this morning. And on the political
it
left,
it is a bright early morning.
Shireen Gourbani.
As we're in the bunker.
Well, I've already been out for a run. Good morning. And hey, listeners.
Happy, happy near spring. But we're going to get more rain and snow this week. And yeah. It's...
I don't even know what time it is. Daylight savings time.
Yeah, you got it. Shireen and John, we had the State of the Union this past week. I remember as a young intern, I was working for Congressman Dan Marriott, and the media guy said, I need you to go pick up a copy of the speech. But I remember feeling like it was so cool that I could go get a copy of the speech and hold it and read it before it was public. It was just so magical to me. So I'm a State of the Union watcher and
junkie
fan.
There
yeah.
And what did you think of this one?
Well, this one, I think that our president swung for the fences and pretty much got it. I mean, you know, regardless of your politics, he was high energy. He didn't have any major mistakes. He was pretty smooth, and he capitalized on his age,
yeah,
which I thought was pretty interesting. Shireen, describe that, because you nod on that when
yeah.
he capitalized on his age.
So, and the first ad is out, too, which also takes the age issue on directly. And what he says is, you know I'm not a young guy, mm-hmm. but I do bring the record of having delivered the biggest infrastructure bill, the most aggressive legislation on energy, dealing with climate change, that he's been able to advance an agenda, even with all of the complications and a really divided, mm-hmm. you know, government. So I think that there's a lot to be said for it. I will also say something that I actually like, and I think listeners will probably disagree with me. Let us know. I kind of like that it's gotten a little more raucous. I like the back and forth. I mean, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene looks like a clown, but I kind of like the interaction from the crowd. Mm. And mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you feel like that's...
Well, I mean, a lot of people thought it crossed a line that it's become so political.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, it was entertaining and it was provocative. And on the age thing, I think there are trade-offs to age. You certainly don't have the energy levels that you can sustain as a young person, but you have more wisdom. And he tapped into that. John, what did you think of the politicization of it?
So I would say it's always political. Mm-hmm. I think what you're referring to from my perspective is more partisan.
Okay.
He is.
Yeah.
For example, he was hardcore calling out the justices of the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and some of them don't attend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're going to now see is most or all of them start to say there is no point for us being here
mm-hmm.
In this situation.
Yeah, that would be unfortunate from my point of view, because this is the gathering is part of the you know, the impact of the moment.
Yeah.
See these people parade in, and it is our government.
And it's one thing for him to talk about policies where he disagrees, but it was more like a personal attack on some of them.
Mm-hmm.
It was where I thought it stepped over the bounds. Now, I'll share what my wife said.
Mm-hmm.
He was coming through high energy, but she just felt like he was an angry old man.
Mm,
it was basically get off my lawn type of thing. And it's
mm-hmm.
just like, you're not coming across as presidential. You were just coming across as angry.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Some of the Democratic, strategists wanted him to look like an angry grandpa.
Yeah.
That was pretty intentional.
Okay. Well, he succeeded then.
He
knocked that one out of the park.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about what they were saying, but I think they were trying to say, not on my watch. You know, I'm standing up in a strong way for the things I believe in and care about. And he went after it. But I could see why your wife would think that. From a policy perspective, did either of you see anything that popped as, you know, new or going to be helpful in the election?
So I noticed, the announcement of a plan to tax the wealthy. Biden vowed to restore federal abortion rights and touted his record on relaxing federal marijuana restrictions and said that basically, people should not go to jail for possession or smoking weed. And couldn't agree more, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible use of our justice system. So I think that there were a number of things that were certainly highlighted that are in line with a more progressive and forward-looking agenda for this country. I think the abortion rights issue is one that is certainly going to be center of mind for many voters this cycle, given the kind of chaos that we're seeing coming out of states that have enacted full bans.
Yeah. John, did you have any policies that were particularly offensive to you? Or?
Well, I mean, he's doubling down on tax and spend. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where he wants to go, you know. Yesterday, he announced a budget that was even bigger than the blowout budgets that we have today. And so it's just, if you're concerned about the first term of his administration, he wants to double down and do even more in the second term. So from my perspective, that's very concerning.
Yeah. Too much government. Too big.
Yeah. Well, and he claims to not want to tax this, that, and the other. At the end of the day, for example, he's saying, you know, we're going to tax corporations. Corporations don't pay taxes. Mm-hmm. People pay taxes. You know, they have to push it on to customers, employees, or shareholders at the end of the day. And so it's a way to hide who actually pays the taxes.
Do you give him any credit as a president and as a person for being a high character, trustworthy person?
No.
Okay.
No.
What about you?
Well, that's the reason I ask it, because the dilemma I'm in is, you know, I have trouble with a lot of his policies, but I take his character over the Republican opponent any day of the week. Any day. And so, you know, that puts me in a tricky situation. I'm hearing that No Labels is going to put forward a candidate.
Well, I don't love this idea.
It'll be a candidate without a label.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And without a chance of winning, right? So then we're talking about fracturing the vote in which it really matters where this individual comes from, what kinds of voters they appeal to. But again, we're talking about an election that's going to come down to a handful of states. Mm-hmm. And in those states, you know, somewhere between, 100,000 and 10,000 votes. So who is that person that they would advance? It's a ridiculous idea.
Totally get why it is alarming to you, frustrating, dangerous. I will say that if our former governor John Huntsman were on the ballot, man, I would love that. but that's where my vote would go.
But you know, I don't know if you saw the announcement from MasterCard.
Yeah, he's the new chairman.
Yeah.
John, let's go to you on the Republican minority response. So this is Senator Katie Britt from Alabama.
Uh huh. Yeah, no, I thought she did a good job. I mean, she was articulate and conveyed a compelling message. I'll share one of my wife's concerns, though, is why did they put the missus in the kitchen? She did not like that. She mm-hmm. wished she was in a different thing. Mm-hmm. Now, I looked at it as compare and contrast, a more homey kind of environment to convey the message of everyday American families mm-hmm. are struggling and they're mm-hmm. around their kitchen table.
That's where things happen. Yeah.
That's where things happen and they're concerned about that. But she didn't like the perception of this woman was in the kitchen when she's a U.S. senator.
Yeah. Shireen, can't wait to hear your comments about Senator Britt.
My comments are, you know, I think being in the kitchen certainly stood out to me. You know, more so, I was concerned that she conveyed a pretty detailed story about a person who had been trafficked into this country, the experience that they had at the border, the experience that they've had struggling to get justice. That is an individual who came into this country who experienced that when Bush was president. That is not something that's happening now. And I think it's really disingenuous to tell that story as though that happened on Biden's watch, that we know this is something that is a categorical struggle at our border, and it is something that is happening when Trump is president, when Biden is president, when Bush is president. But to sit there and try to convey this sense of urgency to the American people with a story without that context is a lie. And I didn't appreciate that.
Yeah. You know, there's this rule in politics that if you get the call to do the State of the Union rebuttal, don't do it.
Yeah, that's right.
It just never turns out well. This is the worst one I've seen. Worst one I've seen.
Why is that?
Oh, because of the inaccuracies in what she said, in the positioning of her message, and then in the delivery. And the delivery was really hard to listen to. It was so, so over the top. It was a caricature of policymaking.
Yeah.
And so I found it really unfortunate. I'm sure she's a bright, articulate woman and has, you know, maybe a great runway ahead of her, but I would have preferred a Republican. I mean, I think the Speaker of the House would have done a great job. Mm. He seems to be holding his own.
Well, I thought this was a place for a, you know, sharp, articulate up-and-coming leader to showcase her skills. So yeah. I thought she did well.
Let's jump to the Utah congressional delegation for a minute. You see Senator Romney in the audience. You see Senator Lee. I want to go to Senator Lee's endorsement of Carrie Lake for the Senate position in Arizona. But what's Senator Lee up to? He looked like an angry person at the State of the Union.
He was tweeting quite a bit.
Was he?
Expressing his concerns about the liberal, progressive Biden agenda.
Did he live tweet during the...
Yeah.
Interesting, because it did look like he was looking at his phone a bit.
Yeah, no, he was live tweeting throughout it, and he was disgusted with what he was hearing.
Yeah, well, so on that, I just want to go back to his endorsement of Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake is running in Arizona, and she's really trying to, I think, shed the mm-hmm. fact that she has been really unhinged these last few years, including election denialism, really extreme right-wing politics.
Is she trying to rewrite her history?
Yes, she is trying to rewrite her history, and I wouldn't be surprised if Senator Lee's going to help her do that.
Mend fences and build bridges again.
But mm-hmm. what's happening in that state is that Senator Sinema has said that she will not run again. And so now Ruben Gallego, who is a veteran, a Democrat, a really interesting and I think compelling character, is running for that seat. I hope that we see a Senator Gallego in short order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any predictions there from you, John?
Not right now.
Yeah,
You know, this goes to what is the mix and who controls the Senate
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
stuff. So and what kind of agenda. I would rather have a more conservative, a limited government agenda.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see.
Even if it means electing an election denier.
We're past that election. We're focusing on where the future is going. And so
democracy can fall apart any time, John, I guess.
No. So the question is, how is she going to govern in the future?
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. And if she wants to rejuvenate herself and focus on the future and how to limit the overreach of the federal government, great.
Hey, in our next segment, we're going to talk about the border a little bit and Governor Cox, Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned, everyone.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and this is both sides of the aisle. Let's talk about Governor Cox for a minute and his interaction with our Homeland Security Secretary, who's been impeached in the House. Am I getting this right?
Yeah.
Alejandro Mayorkas. But Governor Cox is pressing him about the lack of information about the border, about asylum seekers, and I guess expressing a lot of concern about some of the drug trafficking happening in our state because of border policies. So, I mean, John, this is the governor looking after the business of the state. Fair?
Sure.
He's doing what he needs to do.
Yeah. And he's concerned that, you know, our asylum seekers getting shipped off to Utah, we're not being told about it, those dynamics. And so he wants to know. He says you walk through, you know, downtown Salt Lake and it's apparent what's taking place. And he wants to know from the administration, what are they doing about border security? What are they doing to fix the asylum laws, the influx of migrants, and so forth?
So I spent a lot of time in downtown Salt Lake, and I'm just wondering if you could characterize for me what it means to see it's apparent. What's apparent?
No, I'm just saying that's what he says.
I know, but what is he saying? What is he saying?
I'm assuming what he is saying is when you look at the homelessness that are there, when you look at the drug activity that's taking place, that's what he's articulating.
Yeah.
You can see, you know, the homelessness concerns that seem to be just increasing and getting worse. When I talk with folks and
fentanyl crisis is real.
They just are concerned that it just seems like every time they go to downtown, it is not getting fixed. It just seems to get worse for whatever reasons.
I just have to say, as a person who spends a lot of time in downtown Salt Lake City, truly, you know, a couple nights a week, usually I'm down there and often run down through downtown because it's well lit and I mm-hmm. like it. And I'm a person who interacts quite frequently with individuals who are living on the streets in our city, volunteering at the church on 2nd and 2nd that opens up and others. I just really would like to impress upon people that what is happening on our streets is a fraction of what we're seeing in other major cities across the United States. When we see our legislature magically find $2 billion for sports and really not fund fully what the governor had asked for when it comes to responding to the homelessness crisis in our state, I think we need to really reevaluate our priorities. And I just have to say, downtown Salt Lake is not dangerous. And I want people to know that it is a safe mm-hmm. and wonderful place to come. But I will say, I find these kinds of comments from our governor really frustrating. I'm downtown a lot. I've never seen him down there.
His direct quote is, you can literally walk through downtown Salt Lake City and see the impacts. Now, Shereen, this is the way I want to think of it, and this is why I asked the question of you, John, is these are real issues. At what point do they go from real issues to being performative politics?
We've crossed that line.
It's an interesting line, though,
yes,
right?
It is.
Because I want to defend Governor Cox for looking after what needs to be looked after in terms of the safety of our, you know, populace and the concerns about drugs coming into our state. But it's also playing into a political narrative that is very divisive and tricky.
Yeah,
and you're also questioning the timing of it.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that I'm glad he's talking to the Homeland Security Secretary. I'm glad he's asking for more information. I do think he's mischaracterizing downtown Salt Lake City.
Yeah, I do too. And I feel strongly about it. It's my city.
All right. Hey, I want to ask you guys about energy. We said last week we'd talk about energy. It was a big energy session for the Utah legislature. If I can just set this up by saying that Utah's, in economic terms, not every state's an energy state. It's a gift to have energy resources. And Utah's pretty special because we have fossil fuels, we have geothermal, we have wind, we have solar, we have salt hydrogen storage, we have critical minerals.
Yeah.
I mean, this is important to our state. The other thing I would say is that
we have lots of space.
Yeah, and I would say we're facing lots of challenges. First time in 40 years, we were a net importer of energy. So that didn't sit well with a lot of state decision makers. We don't want to be dependent on the outside.
Yeah.
We fear blackouts, things like that. So there's command and control policies from the federal government that are problematic. There's geopolitical developments that can really threaten our energy security. There's a lot of increased energy demand because of a growing population and because of, in the tech age, energy fuels all the things we're addicted to and we use a lot of energy.
And climate.
Yeah, and climate. So my point would be—
Well, out in the basin, there was the railway that's put on hold.
Okay.
And that was to be able to supply more oil to other parts of the nation.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say that state government must take a more active role in energy, given these dynamics. Incredibly important, lots of challenges. You can't just rely on Rocky Mountain Power to take care of us. Can't just rely on the munis to take care of us. We got to have more state thinking about it. So that's my setup.
Okay. So in that setup, I guess I would just ask, when you're thinking about, and I feel like something I've heard you say before, is we really need to be taking an all of the above approach to energy in our state. Do you think this year, would you say generally you would characterize this as an all of the above approach year?
There's been a lot of writing about this because what they did is do some things that really laid the groundwork for longer coal dependence in this state.
Yeah.
Something like that. And, John, one of the ways they did that is by creating, I can't remember what it was called, but it's like another authority, but a group that will look after the transition of the Intermountain Power Project, or the IPP, in Delta. That is our largest coal-fired power plant that is being reconfigured right now to be natural gas, but reconfigured means they're just building a natural gas plant next to it that uses the same power lines. And this particular group will look after how could we keep IPP functioning as a coal-fired power plant to meet Utah's energy needs.
Yeah,
is that how you understand it? I mean, I'm just...
Well, so my understanding is they are looking to see, and they want a first right of refusal that if IPP is mothballing it, that the state has an option to acquire it. I think the state is looking, and they don't believe, I think they're skeptical about whether California's drive to a greener future is actually going to materialize. I think they are thinking California is going to want more reliable power.
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point in the future, they're going to want to go back to what they were doing before, and they want to be prepared for that.
So this is SB 161, and it creates the Decommissioned Asset Disposition Authority. So, John, this is another authority you can add to your list.
Oh, and you know I love those authorities.
And just to be clear to our listeners, none of us are energy experts, but what
but we're playing one on the radio.
What the plan is you have a coal-fired power plant, you're building a natural gas-fired power plant next to it, which is cleaner and makes California happier. They're the major consumers here. And then they're going to convert it to hydrogen.
95% of what the power that IPP produces goes to California.
Yeah, so it's a California issue, but it goes from coal to natural gas to hydrogen. That's the plan. But the idea is that you'll have a coal-fired power plant that has the potential to be decommissioned, and the state's saying, hey, we've got coal, we've got energy needs, why are we decommissioning this?
Yes. Well, and there's also a real serious argument for the workers out there. The transition from the coal-fired plant to natural gas is going to be a significant reduction in workforce.
And don't forget coal miners.
Coal miners.
That are in adjacent counties.
Completely, yes. So there is a larger ecosystem of workers that is significantly impacted by this. I think the thing that's concerning to me, right, is that when we know that we're warming at the rate that we're warming, and we're seeing the impacts of climate change in the way that we're seeing them, I'm disappointed to see that kind of the two major pieces of legislation that were really focusing around energy policy did not help move us forward on that. And in fact, the opportunities, I think, to take more of an all-of-the-above approach were really sidelined this session.
I'll make a prediction that this authority does its job and looks at what the potential options are. And we're going to hear more to this story. And I'm all for getting more information.
More information. I agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, they did not make a decision. They created a process to make a decision. And I think that's
to have an option.
Probably pretty good state policy. But I also will say that there's no question that this is going to be an active area, meaning there's the costs of renewables are falling, and the climate challenges facing our world and our country are increasing. And so there's some decisions that are going to have to be made.
Well, and one of the key things, and the folks in the energy sector will talk about dispatchable power. This is the reliable base load that's always there. And when we talk about renewables, it's the, is it working when the wind is blowing or when the sun is shining? How do we have the reliability around the clock? And so that people demand reliable energy. They want affordable energy. And we're in a world in which there's going to be, our use of energy is a measure of our economic vitality.
Yeah.
And we're going to demand more and more energy going forward.
Watch for nuclear to be talked about more and more and more in this state. We're not currently a state that uses nuclear power, but it's in the Rocky Mountain power plans. This is a Green River Emery County move. It would take the transmission lines and use them with a nuclear plant that is dispatchable, but very expensive, takes time to do. You have to have a bridge to it.
And the regulatory agencies are trying to build their muscles to deal with this. They've been a wet blanket.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you want to say anything else about energy, Shereen?
Just that I would say, I think it is in our best interest of the state to go back to that kind of notion of really trying to pursue viable routes that can also help address the climate change we're experiencing every day.
Shereen, it's been a while since we've had our Attorney General Sean Reyes on the program.
Well, he's never been on.
and we're learning
that
more.
That is quite a while.
Yeah, it's a while.
We're learning quite a bit about his commentary and text messages with unsavory people.
Yeah. So this is
how do you want to set this up?
Yeah. So this is going back to the pretty concerning relationship that our attorney general had with Tim Ballard, who was the director of Operation Underground Railroad, that had significant allegations of impropriety and misconduct come forward. But as this was happening, Senator Nate Bluin, who is quite a tweeter. I've gotten off Twitter, so I don't know exactly what he's up to, but I'm sure he called out directly the controversies surrounding Tim Ballard's behavior that was really pretty significantly highlighted in the news this fall. And at that time, my understanding is that our attorney general said in a text to Ballard that Senator Nate Bluin was a punk and should be sued for what he said. Now, I have to say this, I mean, I kind of like poking the bear. I understand, wanting to sound off like this on Twitter.
What do you think of Smokey the Bear?
I'm also a fan of Smokey the Bear. It's going to become more important as our entire world burns because of climate change. But I think that there's a real, I'm really concerned. I don't always love how people kind of portray themselves on Twitter or the kind of fights they get into on Twitter. But I do find it extra concerning when our attorney general is stepping into a phrase like this.
John, I would just say you're an elected official, and I've staffed a lot of elected officials, and it's just never good to call somebody a punk in any kind of.
Well, you always have to assume whatever you send privately will eventually be made public.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the key things is Sean is a really big-hearted guy. He wants to do good things. He wants to help people.
Fair.
And he bought hook, line, and sinker, the OUR story. And I think he's starting to, learn more and more and more about the problems that he wasn't seeing at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've all made mistakes in our private communications, so I'm with you there. Hey, let's talk for a minute about Senator Todd Weiler.
Todd is a regular listener.
Regular listener. I like to think of him as a political moderate, and so he's
sometimes been on this show. He actually has been on this show.
And we share a lot in common, and we're thinking about Senator Weiler because he's undergoing some cancer treatment.
Yeah. This is one of those things. It's always concerning when somebody has health challenges, and so we wish him the best to him and his family, every success in fighting this thing. Todd is a fighter. And so I'm very optimistic that he will get through this.
Yeah.
But clearly there's hurdles and challenges that he will face going through that treatment. And we know Todd. There's many others that have similar challenges that we don't know. So always look to how do you help those that are going through difficult times.
I have certainly found him to be a person with a very big heart. And I am just wishing him and his family so well during
this time. We're rooting for you, Todd. All right. Thanks, everybody. Great program. Shereen Gurbani, John Dougal, and Natalie Gochner. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.